South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, and a very good morning across San Antonio, the Hill Country, South Texas, wherever you may happen to be listening on the internet. Well, it's beautiful, beautiful morning around here. Moon's out there just kind of sinking down in the sky, a little bit of haze over it. The temperature's very nice. Cool, you know, if you're out walking or something like that, it's comfortable just like this. If you're up in the hill country, you may put on a light jacket, but for now, at least, spring is really in the air. Sure starting to look like we're beyond the danger of any really cold weather. It's going to be chilly toward the end of this next week if the weathermen are anywhere close to accurate. Ha ha. But anyway, we're coming up on a beautiful stretch of weather. Lots and lots of things to do outside. Lots and lots of things to talk about. And that's what we're here for the next 3.5 hours to do. Jimmy tells me pretty much we have an open board there. So if you'd like to get in early, this is what I call Smart People's Half Hour, where we don't have any commercial breaks up until 6 o'clock, so gives us time to go into depth about your question if you have something that's a little bit more complex, or maybe you just like to get your call in early and pour that second cup of coffee and get your day started. Anyway, you know the number, 210-599-5555, 210-599-5555. Been getting a lot of questions about roses lately because, well, number one, they are so beautiful right now. But everybody's got questions about pruning, and absolutely, you should have done any pruning that your roses need before now. If you do any pruning now, you're going to be sacrificing a lot of blooms. I guess if something's just out of hand, you may need to cut it back a little bit, but excuse me, and it's okay to cut dead wood out anytime, but above all, don't prune on your climbing roses. I've had several people in the nursery this week asking about pruning climbing roses. Climbing roses bloom on wood that grew last fall, so if you prune them before they bloom, well, then you're sacrificing all your flowers. You're cutting all your buds off. So on your climbers, if they need any pruning, and climbers are usually not pruned nearly as heavy as bush roses are, but if they do need any pruning, let them have their first big flush of blooms. In some cases, it'll be the only batch of blooms you get. They don't bloom, at least many climbers don't bloom over nearly as long a period as bush roses do, but very, very important in the spring. Enjoy the flowers first, and then do any pruning that you need to do. And that goes for the modern hybrids as well as the basic species roses. Looking at a lot of pretty, what they call Lady Banks roses, Rosa Banksia. There's a yellow form and a white form, and they're just about to come into full bloom. And boy, talk about something that just covers itself with flowers. If you're looking for a big rose, and by the way, they have no thorns, so this is a rose that's not going to poke you puncture you, so to speak. Both the yellow and the white form get quite large. They can easily be, oh gosh, the one in my front yard is probably about 8 feet tall and about 10 or 12 feet wide. So if you're looking for something big, if you're looking for a screening plant, again, people are always looking for something that'll make a nice kind of barrier hedge to screen out neighbors or screen out traffic noise or something like that. If you've got room for it, you really ought to look at the Lady Banks roses, because once established, they are very, very trouble-free. I water mine 2 or 3 times a year. Always beautiful flowers in the spring. Unfortunately, that's pretty much all the blooms you're going to get for the year. But it is still an attractive green shrub. It is dense enough that it does pretty much stop a lot of noise. Certainly a nice visual barrier. Only thing about it, it gets big. You've got to have enough room for it to get, 6-8 feet wide. It's going to encroach out of the yard a ways. So small yard may not be your best choice for a screen. But if you've got room for it, it's certainly one to consider. Another thing about the Lady Banks roses, too, is that they are one of the, in fact, they're about the only rose I know that the deer don't care much for. Now, hungry as deer are right now, they may prune on, almost eat on almost anything, but Lady Banks roses are usually among our what we would call deer-resistant plants, and they are certainly the most deer-resistant of all the roses. And again, it's not a great big not a great big bush by any means, but not a great big flower. It is a great big bush, but not a great big flower. But it is certainly attractive and certainly deserves to be considered on your list of screening plants. Well, it looks like we've got some folks ready to talk. It's going to be Thomas and Julie and Gloria. So, Jimmy, let's just go ahead and get started. Bring up Thomas, and I get to say good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Bob.
Well, good morning, sir. You're up bright and early.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about mixing my own seed starter mix. You know,
okay.
I used to use that ladybug I used to sell, and I've got azomite, I've got lava sand, compost, Medina, growing green, and cornmeal, and core.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do with all that stuff?
Well, I would make my basic germinating medium, as it were. It's going to be mainly compost based, and I'd probably do maybe 2/3 compost, and it needs to be finished compost. It needs to be beyond the heat producing stage, but I do maybe 2/3 compost and 1/3 core. Add just a little bit of azomite to, if you're mixing, say, a 5-gallon bucket full of soil, probably a tablespoon or two full of azomite. I'm not real big on putting much fertilizer into your germination trays. I would be ready to, after your seedlings sprout, I'd be ready to follow it up with some has to grow or something like that. But, you know, the only other thing, if you wanted to add a little bit of lava sand to it, you could. That basically, your compost and core will give you a pretty good base as a germinating medium. Now, cornmeal, if you want to work a little bit in, you certainly can. In fact, again, to that 5-gallon bucket, probably 3 or 4 tablespoons. But I think the most important place for the cornmeal is on the surface after you plant your seed. Dust it with cornmeal, because that's going to protect your little seedlings from damping off and a number of other things. But really, well, I guess it wouldn't be bad to mix a little bit in. But even if you mix some into the medium, go ahead and dust it lightly over the top after you plant your seeds. If you have a mortar and pestle, one of those little grinding things, you could even grind your cornmeal down to more of a powder instead of a granule, and that'd be ideal for sprinkling around. But that should give you a good medium to germinate. What kind of seeds are you planning to start?
Well, I've got some tatumi squash.
Uh-huh.
And I've got some English cucumbers.
Okay.
And I got a lot of contender beans.
Okay.
Green beans.
Okay. Well, those are all things that they don't really like being transplanted. It's not like tomatoes and peppers, where we're going to start like a seedling tray, start the little plants, and then transfer them into their individual pots. I would make your germinating mix, and then I would go ahead and put it into 4-inch pots. I don't want you to have to try to transplant them after they've sprouted. And then I would just poke 1 or 2 seeds down in each of these 4-inch pots, maybe 1/2 inch deep. And that's how I would go about that. This is going to be a little bit different than starting a whole flat full of tomatoes or peppers or eggplant or something like that. But that would be a good medium for germinating the seed and also growing it up to a size that you want to put it into the garden. Now, once again, all three things you mentioned, squash, cucumbers, and beans, they don't really... They just don't transplant super well, so not going to let them get real big in the pots. With your beans, by the time they've got their second set of true leaves, they should go into the ground. Your cucumbers and squash, really, once they have fully matured their first set of true leaves, you can go ahead and move them out in the garden. So this is not something you're going to keep in those pots for a long period of time. It'll slow it down once they actually get into the garden. So just let them get up to, make a nice start. By the time they've got that second set of leaves forming, the roots should have reached the bottom of the 4-inch pot, and I'd transplant at that point. I wouldn't grow them on, let them get very big in 4-inch pots. If your garden's ready to go, get them up to where they're just healthy young plants, 3-4 inches tall, and then get them out in the garden where they belong.
Okay. Now, on the core, I've got this Coco Loco.
Uh-huh.
What do you think about that stuff?
Hey, it's as good as any core out there. One thing about it, they've probably checked it to be sure. But the only negative about core is that sometimes, especially the stuff comes out of Sri Lanka, has a little bit too much salt in it, too much sea salt, too much sodium. But when you're getting a packaged brand like that, chances are that's not going to be a problem. And core is a great substitute. Just anywhere that you've got a blend or anything that calls for Canadian peat moss, I would substitute core. And the combination of core along with some good compost makes a really good medium for either rooting or actually for growing things on.
Bob, what's a good variety of English cucumber?
Oh, boy. Chelsea Pride is one that comes to mind. I've never found a really bad variety. The one thing about the English cucumbers is they don't tolerate the heat quite as well as some of the other varieties. So if you grow with English cucumbers, that's something you need to get started pretty soon. But I think Chelsea Pride is the one that I've grown. But I don't think there's a really bad one out there. Just like I say, keep in mind that they are more an early season cucumber. And then for late season, if you're looking for a small cucumber, the Persian cucumbers, the one they call Persian little fingers or something like that, is great for a cucumber that's about a 4-inch cucumber or so. And then you've got your straight H, your national pickling. You've got an awful lot of bigger cucumbers that will do well through the later summer months. And if you want a giant cucumber, if you want to really impress people with what you can grow, plant some Armenian cucumbers. They're interesting. They're ribbed kind of like English cucumbers, but they're white in color. And they will make an enormous cucumber. They stay relatively tender, even if they're 10 or 12 inches long, and they will get even bigger than that. So lots of good choices when it comes to cucumbers.
Okay, Bob. Well, I appreciate your time.
Well, just get your growing medium, your potting medium going, Thomas, but be sure you're also getting that soil in the vegetable garden ready where you're ultimately going to set these things. Go ahead, and that's where I'd be putting that growing green fertilizer down, put a little bit of compost on top of it. And like I say, your plants aren't going to really spend a lot of time in 4-inch pots. When those seeds first sprout, which will be 5 to 7 days on both squash, cucumbers, and beans, go ahead and give them one feeding with like has to grow plant, but then they'll be ready to go in the ground. And if you've gotten your growing green in there and gotten it started to break down, you'll be in great shape.
Now let me ask you this real quick. Okay, I got this down. What about if I on potting soil, if you want to mix your own potting soil, what variation would you do on that?
I'd do probably the same sort of thing, but I definitely would add some lava sand to it. But beyond that, I don't really see any reason to add much else. If you start bringing in actual soil, you're introducing a lot of potential for weeds. You're introducing more potential for disease, but as a potting soil, pretty much a combination of core, finished compost, and, some lava sand in there, that's going to be good. Now, adding some azomite, adding some green sand, those would be good additions, but that's about all you need to make a good potting soil.
Okay. Well, sounds good. All I got to do is get out there and do it.
Yes, sir, and it's going to be a pretty day to do it. It's going to get pretty warm this afternoon, but it's going to be a beautiful morning and early afternoon, Thomas, so you get out and enjoy, and it's always good to hear your voice. Appreciate you calling this morning.
Okay, well, thank you, Thomas. Thank you
yes.
for your time.
It's my pleasure, and thank you, sir. And, Jimmy, let's go ahead and bring up Julie. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
This is Julie from Norman. So
right. I can always count on a wide-awake voice from you, so it's good to talk to you.
I'm up. Okay, I have several questions, and that actually helped me a lot because you've said some things that will help. But we are getting all the pots out today from last year. I put them in the little barn, and I'm bringing them all out, and I want to spruce up the soil. And I guess maybe just what you said, maybe to add a little lava sand and azomite to all of the old soil. You can tell it's real dry and powdery.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks pretty bad, but it's not. It's all organic. So.
Sure. Sure. And if you want to add a little compost, in this case, rather than actually bulking it up with compost, the thing you're doing is putting a very active microbial culture back in there. But so these are empty pots that you're getting ready to plant again.
They're not empty. I mean, like, there's soil already in the pots.
But I mean, there are no plants in them yet.
No. And so that kind of helped because I just made a list of everything you said, and I have a hard time getting azomite here. I don't know why I begged people to get it. I have to get it from Amazon or somewhere, you know.
Oh wow, and it's anyway. Well, Amazon's gotten amazing. I kicked myself for not buying stock in Amazon early on because that company has it's just amazing. And there are a lot of brick and mortar stores that really need to get their act together, or they're going to be out of business. I mean, looking at everything from office supplies to shoes to just about anything you can imagine, Amazon gets it to you overnight, and these other folks, well, it's kind of when we get around to it. So, yeah, if you and keep in mind, too, that there's both a powdered form of azomite and a little bit more granular form, and it's hard to figure out. A lot of nurseries and people that call themselves nurseries that really don't deserve that term are just way behind on the things they ought to be keeping in stock. So,
I begged them, and you even asked them about mycorrhizal and all that. They don't even know what I'm talking about here. So, anyway, a couple other things. We have an area that faces due west, and of course, in the morning and late evening, it's got beautiful. The environment is beautiful for a plant, but for about 3 or 4 hours in the summer, it literally bakes whatever I put there.
Right.
And I was wondering, would coleus be okay there?
Only
the hardier ones.
Yeah, only a few varieties, and unfortunately, they're not in my opinion, not the really pretty ones. The only coleus that's ever been developed specifically for the sun is a variety called Alabama. Yeah, that would do okay. But when you compare that to things like the periwinkles and, you know, even marigolds and some of your different annual salvias. And if you've never grown Angelonia, that's another one that is very happy in the bright sun. Comes in three basic colors, but just a beautiful little bedding plant that will flower all summer long for you. I can think of a lot of things beyond coleus. If you're looking for colorful foliage that will be a little bit easier, of course, the old-fashioned copper plant, and there's several varieties of it. Acalpha is its botanical name. But there are some alternanthera, some of the Joseph's coats, that are that will tolerate that sun probably better than coleus. And if you're looking for, you know, a vine that practically becomes a weed, the so-called potato vine, the ipomeas, are amazingly sun tolerant, and even the variegated one, which I love, it looks like it's a wimp. It just, you know, has that kind of gray, green, and white and pink shades to it, and it just looks like it wouldn't be. That plant is the prettiest bed of it I ever saw. It was up in the Dallas Botanical Garden in absolute full sun on a west-facing hillside in August when I saw it, and it was absolutely at perfection. So that's another fun thing to consider for something that will grow and trail out of the pots. And you combine that with some of the more upright things, you'll do really well. If you've never tried clayamy, you might try clayamy. An interesting plant. Some of the Gallardias are very sun tolerant and really pretty. And then, you know, there are always the basics like purslane and portulaca and some of the more succulent things. But there are a lot of things that will tolerate that afternoon Norman sun.
Okay, well, we actually came to Shades of Green last Thursday and Friday both.
Really?
And I filled up the back of my SUV, but mainly with products, not so much with plants, because I can't find these. But I got your list of things for, you know, different areas and stuff like that. So, and I think it's, I mean, we have heat like you all have heat. So we just have a little more cold. Okay, and we bought a hawthorn from you all. And I wondered if... about that plant. They were beautiful. Your bougainvilleas were wonderful. Oh my gosh, were gorgeous.
We've got some good growers.
Okay, so what about the hawthorn?
It should do, you know, Indian hawthorn likes good soil and it likes good sun. Believe it or not, a lot of our Indian hawthorn and some of our shrubs actually come out of Oklahoma. Greenleaf Nursery Company has a division up there. Can't say off the top of my head the name of the city that it's near, but you might be getting an Indian hawthorn that's kind of going back home, because I know when the El Campo, Texas division runs short, we frequently get things from Greenleaf, Oklahoma. So, it's a good shrub, and it just wants better soil than most. It wants a good deal of compost in there. And it should do fine for you. Which variety did you get?
Oh, gosh. Whatever you had out on the side of your the building.
Well, could have been pinky.
It was right when you walked into the building. So.
Oh, I know exactly where they sit out there. I'm sorry I didn't get to meet you when you were in. I'm here on Fridays all day usually, but Pinky is a little compact one. Pink Lady is a little bit more upright growing, and it'll reach 5 feet tall. And then the Snow White is just like a white version of Pink Lady. So
we got the one that was a little higher, because this one already looks like it's about 3 feet high. So.
Okay, well, that's probably Pink Lady, and that's going to make a beautiful shrub that'll grow ultimately 4 or 5 feet tall and give you pretty nice spring flowers.
Okay, good deal. Okay, well, thank you so much. I got my questions answered, and I appreciate it very much.
Enjoy your spring while it lasts, because we all know summer's coming.
Oh, it is already, about half a day sometimes. So, okay, well, thank you, and have
You're
a great
welcome,
weekend.
Julie. You have a good weekend, and let's get Gloria in here before the 6 o'clock news break. Good morning, Gloria. Gloria, are you there? Jimmy, are we hearing anything on the phone line there?
No, she's pulled up.
I think, okay, are you there, Gloria?
Hello? Yes,
good morning.
I'm sorry. Good morning. When I spray the liquid seaweed to prevent... spider mites. Can I also add the Medina Hastegrove and
absolutely
spinosad at the same time, because I'm trying to maximize that 2 gallon sprayer when I have it?
Absolutely. In fact, the Hastegrove already has some liquid seaweed in it. So if you want to bump it up with a little bit of extra, that'll just take a good product and make it even better.
Okay. Good. I'll do that. Thank you.
That all you need?
That's all I need. Everything's great so far.
Well, you just keep up the good work. Be doing it about every 2 weeks. And one other thing that you might consider adding would be a little bit of molasses. Molasses, of course, is a very strong microbial stimulant. And where you're using this foliar spray, it stimulates a lot of good microbial life on the leaves and stems. And so I think molasses is a really good thing where you're looking for both just a good tough plant and also where you're trying to fight the spider mites. In fact, our mixture is usually like 2 tablespoons of seaweed, 1 tablespoon molasses to a gallon of water. So get some good liquid molasses and add that to your mix as well.
Okay, I'll do that. And I just thought of one other question. Strawberries. I have some beautiful plants, and they have some have bloomed and some have strawberries on them. I'm thinking about putting down straw. Is that a good idea? I don't want to create a haven for any insects.
If it's clean straw, yes. Just keep in mind that hay and straw are two different things. And so much hay has been sprayed with herbicides, you want to be sure that's not an issue. But putting down some straw to keep the berries up off the ground is a good idea. I would be proactive probably and put out a little Sluggo Plus as well, because the main thing that's going to go after those berries is going to be pill bugs. And you'll have pill bugs whether you have straw down or not. But a little bit of Sluggo Plus is totally safe. And just in growing strawberries, you want every berry to be perfect. So little Sluggo Plus along with it, and you should be in good shape.
And I'm assuming that Medina Growing Green is my best fertilizer on those as well. And are they heavy feeders?
They're fairly heavy feeders, but after they're up and growing, switch to a liquid like the Medina Has to Grow. I can get Jimmy to put you back on hold, but I've got to go to news here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, back to gardening on what's going to be an absolutely glorious, if a little bit warm, weekend out there. Not going to be bad. Not going to be anything like summertime weather, but hey, I've got shorts and short sleeves on today, and I think that's going to be comfortable gardening attire. Just wear that hat and use some sunscreen, because many of you haven't been out in the sun until the weather's gotten just so nice recently. But it's going to be a great day for gardening and so many things to do, and that's what we're here to talk about. We apparently got all of Gloria's questions answered, so my next list is going to be Larry and James and Mark, and let's just get back to phone calls. Larry is first in line. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
The question I have is a large tree close to the house, and the question is, does a large oak tree pose a problem to the integrity of my house foundation?
And is your home on a slab or on pier and beam?
Slab.
And what was there first, your house or the tree?
Well, I had the house built, and part of the regulations for the builder is to plant some trees, and he put 2 oak trees up there. At that time, they were probably about a fistful in width and size.
Yeah, no, but that, yeah, you're fine there. I would worry a little bit if, you know, if this was already a big tree and you poured your foundation on top of it. Even that is not usually a problem, because the edge of your foundation should be what they call a grade beam, where they don't just pour the slab on top of the ground. They put, you know, deeper areas through there, especially on the periphery. And I do not think that tree would pose. How far away from your home is the tree planted?
I guess 15 to 20. It all depends.
Oh, yeah. And how far away?
About 15 feet or 20 feet.
Oh, 15 to 20 feet. No worries whatsoever. There's nothing under the slab of your foundation that would be appealing to a tree root. There's no oxygen. There's no moisture to speak of. It's not a good root environment. The tree's going to grow 99.9% of its roots out the other direction. Some roots will grow toward the slab, but they're not going to go underneath it. 10 years from now, if you went out there and, you know, started digging around, you probably would see where roots had gone up next to the slab and then just kind of branched and gone either direction. But I'd say your chances are slim to none that there would ever be a problem with those trees. Don't let anybody tell you they pose a threat to your foundation, because they don't.
Okay. The thing is that the tree is just like 2-3 feet away from the pavement, you know, the road.
Yeah.
And it's beginning to dip right in front of the tree.
Well, the road's a different thing, and somebody else going to worry about the road, and even sidewalks and driveways and things. We sometimes have to modify those to accommodate for the tree roots. But, and trees, a big oak tree might grow its roots all the way clear under that road and over to the lot across the street. So that doesn't surprise me as much. But your foundation has a grade beam along the edge there. There's nothing underneath the foundation that would be attractive to a tree root. So, that's one thing I wouldn't worry about. Those trees are far enough away that someday you'll probably have to do a little pruning on the top just to keep the leaves from rubbing on the shingles, but that's they're right. not going to be a problem rubbing on the eaves or the fascia or anything like that. So, the only thing I would have done differently is probably plant, one oak and one something else there. But these trees are in great shape. Don't worry about your foundation. There are plenty of other things in life that you can worry about, but that's not one of them.
Well, thank you very much. You gave me a peace of mind.
You're certainly where I appreciate the call, Larry. Thank you. All right, let's move along. And James is next in line. Good morning, James.
Morning, Bob. How you doing?
Well, this is Farmer James. Good morning. Oh, the day's off to a good start, and it's going to be a beautiful day.
Yes, sir. It certainly is. I just wanted to call you all and tell you that it's been a pretty good spring for the hoop house tomatoes there. Well, some of them about 4 foot tall and got little green tomatoes on them, so we're doing pretty good with our new system.
Sounds like you are off to a very good start. And what varieties did you plant? What's going in the hoop house?
It's a celebrity.
Yeah.
It's a determinate tomato.
It's semi-determinate. It's semi-determinate. It's not fully determinate, but yeah, it's one of the best producers out there. It makes not a tiny plant, but it's not. It doesn't just make the big vine that the indeterminates do. So real good choice. Celebrity's always whatever. I plant a lot of other things to experiment with, but Celebrity's always going to be the core of my garden. So I'm glad you feel the same way.
Yes, sir. The 1 gallon jalapenos, the hybrid jalapenos, it's called the Jedi. It's what I like to use in my production.
Uh-huh.
I haven't gone out yet, but I'm waiting for another week or so when I'm sure that the weather's going to be right.
Easter comes along a week from tomorrow, and generally once we get past Easter, the weather's going to be pretty right for peppers and even eggplant. That's another thing that I enjoy growing, especially that Ichiban, that long Japanese eggplant that never gets bitter. That's something else that I always think about this time of year.
The weatherman's talking about Wednesday that it's going to be a high of 75 and then 2 days with a high of 65. And I'm thinking that would be pretty good weather to transplant the cantaloupe and the Benary zinnias out.
Oh, yeah.
So 265-day will be better than 95-day on a transplant.
Amen to that. And as long as we don't get too much wind, because, a cool, dry wind, but, you do what I do. You give them a little protection with from that wind. And yeah, it looks like toward the end of next week it's our strongest rain chance in quite a while, and that rain chance is spread out over a 3 to 4 day period, and we're gonna have, I think I looked, and it's gonna be today, tomorrow, and Monday gonna be pretty warm, but after that the temperatures get real moderate, and looks like it's just gonna be a beautiful stretch of weather in there.
Well, yeah, I'd like to get those transplants in before the rains they're talking about.
Right.
That's what I was going to ask you about, if you feel the same way I do about getting them out.
I just love getting things in the ground where they just have unlimited space to get the roots started. And you do like I do. You prepare your soil well in advance. It's not like you're just tilling the garden for the first time or whatever. And, even so, I totally agree. I think it's time to get the transplants out. But where your soil is ready, where you've already got, have added some fertilizer, have composted it well. No, those little transplants don't miss a beat. They go in the ground and they just explode into growth. So I'm with you 100%. You've been doing this a long time, and I think we've both learned a lot of techniques and getting them before they. It's a big misconception that plants mind being root bound. They love being root bound, but if you let them get real root bound in that little pot, then you need to take your thumb and forefinger and just kind of tear out a little part of the bottom just to get those roots spread out and growing. And the sooner you get them in the ground, once they're up and have two or three sets of true leaves on them, in my opinion, if the weather's right there, they need to go in the garden as soon as you can. Of course, I always put out a little bit of Slug-O Plus and things like that, because they're plenty of hungry snails and slugs around after a long winter that would happily munch on those things. But Slug-O Plus is so safe. It's just spinosad and not going to harm people or pets or anything else. So, yeah, it's going to be a good day and a good week for getting a lot of things done out there.
Bob, those Veneri Genius, that's a really nice variety. They'll get 4 foot tall in a good year and really come on, man. I don't know if you're aware of that variety that Johnny sells, but
yeah,
they're really spectacular.
I've heard of it, but I haven't grown them yet. I've always been a big fan of Dreamland, because that's the one. The old-fashioned zinnias, the old-fashioned seed zinnias, you pretty much get one big crop of blooms, and you have to plant about three different crops of them through the summer months to really have pretty zinnias over a long period of time. But the Dreamland is one that reblooms over and over, and I guess this Veneri is probably bred along the same lines to where it will rebloom pretty much constantly through the summer months. And is it at all resistant to the mildew, or do you
it is
good.
That's the reason we choose it, because it is mildew resistant, and the blooms are some of them 4 to 5 inches in diameter. They're just really spectacular.
Yeah. Well, and you grow it as a cut flower or as a garden plant, or both?
Cut flower and also insect attractant.
Very good. Well, you got your week cut out for you, and you get out and enjoy, James. Always good to hear from you.
Always good to talk to you, Bob.
Thank you so much for all your insight and all your sharing your years of experience with us. Really appreciate it. And let me get a break in here. Mark, you will be up next, but I get to talk for a moment about my friend Fred Morales down at Morales Feed. And again, there are not many people in the business that I respect as much as I do Fred Morales, because he is a man who loves the land and who really, it hurts him what people have done to the land over the past 100 years, burning out all the organic material, doing so much to destroy the microbial life in the soil. And he is a scientist of soil, so to speak. He knows what it takes to get your soil in good shape and get your land productive or back to being more productive. And he's always looking for new and different things. And he has come up with a compost source that, again, it's not what I recommend for your lawn or your vegetable garden, but a reasonably priced compost that is good for use on hay fields or for open land. And gosh, across South Texas, our organic content has dipped so low. That's why the production is so bad. That's why the soils compact so badly and then erode when it rains. Let me tell you, Fred's out there to help you increase the microbial content by increasing the organic material. In fact, he can even put the compost out for you. He has several different programs. He can actually do the spreading and everything. He can load the compost into a spreader And you can pick it up, spread it with your own equipment, or like I say, it can just be a turnkey thing. You tell them, hey, I've got 10 acres that I really need to improve. He'll take care of the job for you. Keep in mind, too, that Morales Feed has been around for a long time, and they offer a lot of other quality products, K-line irrigation products, along with a lot of different very quality-oriented feeds for both your domestic pets and for your livestock. Good man with a great, great company. It's Morales Feed. And ask him about his new compost source to really get your land back healthy again.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening on a, what's going to be a beautiful Sunday. Still pretty dark out there right now, but it's going to turn out to be a really nice day and just a great, great day for gardening. Jimmy tells me we've got some open lines. Mark's going to be my next caller, but if you'd like to get in line behind him, you know the number, 210-599-5555. So let's get back to it, and good morning, Mark.
Hey, good morning, Bob. How are you?
Off to a good start. It's, it really is starting to feel like spring out there, and it's really starting to look like spring, too, depending on, you know, where you're driving. Fair crop of wildflowers out there, and a lot of our spring flowering shrubs are really coming on, and gosh, who can complain about the beautiful foliage that's coming out? It's just a pretty time of year.
Yes, sir. So I have a couple questions, but the first one is crepe myrtle. So I planted a couple 2 years ago, a little too much shade, and I was thinking of transplanting them. They're, 4 feet tall, maybe 5 feet, pretty small. Mm-hmm. But is this a good time to transplant them?
Well, yes and no. It would have been a lot better to do it back in December or January. But if you don't transplant them now, then the next transplanting opportunity is going to be about October. And the way crepe myrtles grow, they will be that much bigger. Their roots will be that much more spread out. If they've just been in the ground for a couple of years, I would go ahead and do it. Of course, keep in mind that you don't ever want to let the root system dry out. Have your new hole dug and ready. Get those, dig them up. And in some ways, it's probably a good thing because virtually every crepe myrtle that gets sold is already too deep in the pot. So this is going to give you a real good opportunity to identify where that root flare actually starts on that crepe myrtle and be sure that you have it right at ground level. 4 feet tall in the ground for 2 years? No, that's still a very transplantable stage, but I'd get it done as quickly as possible.
Okay, great. Thanks. And then coleus, those are good, okay for pots, and how long do they last through the summer?
Coleus, depending on the variety, there are some varieties that tolerate sun. Most varieties really prefer a more shady area. But coleus should last the entire season. I mean, they should be still going strong when freeze gets them next fall. So the one thing that you will find, and this varies a little bit from variety to variety, but as we get later into the summer, a lot of them start blooming, and when they start putting on that little spike of purplish flowers, they're not growing as many of their colorful leaves, and coleus are something, of course, we grow for the leaves, not for the flowers. So as you get later into the summer, you'll find yourself spending a little time every few days just going in and pinching off the bloom spikes so that they'll continue to produce plenty of colorful leaves. But my gosh, coleus they're dependable. They're very hardy. Only a handful of insects get after them. You may see occasional aphids. If they're good and healthy, probably not. You can occasionally see mealybug. Once again, they're not common on a healthy plant. But just choose your varieties well, and you're set. Great plants with very little maintenance. They are thirsty. They don't ever want to get bone dry. And when you first set them out, you want to be sure that you water regularly. But always feel the soil. Don't base it on how the plant looks. I say if a plant's droopy in the afternoon, don't worry. It may just be the heat. If it's still droopy the next morning, it needs to be watered. And But no, coleus will be great. I want to back up to the crepe myrtles for just 1 second, though. And after you transplant them and for the next few weeks, keep in mind that they will absorb a lot of moisture directly through that soft bark. So water them appropriately, which means really soaking them when you water, but then letting them get dry, you know, a knuckle or two deep before you water again. But if you want to take your hose and just spray down over the limbs and trunk, developing trunks of the crepe myrtles, if you want to do that 6 times a day, the plants would love you for it, and that's going to help minimize transplant shock. But anyway, you should do well with your crepe myrtles or your coleus, both. What else can I help you with?
That was about it. It's not too late to plant tomatoes, right?
Oh, no. You're still in good shape to plant tomatoes. Just, again, do it properly. Remember that you can plant tomatoes much deeper. We were just talking about crepe myrtles and other things, how important it is to have the root flare up on the surface. Tomatoes are just the opposite. If they've gotten a little tall or a little leggy, plant them deep. They'll grow roots all the way up and down the stem. I know people that will take the taller ones and actually make a little trench and kind of plant them on their side, cover them with soil, and just let the top of them be up out of the ground. In fact, that's the way a lot of commercial growers do it. So you're still going to find a good selection at the nurseries and a great time to get them in the ground and growing.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. Appreciate it.
Well, you're certainly welcome. I appreciate the call. Thank you. All right. My next three callers are going to be Joe and Greg and John, and Joe is up first. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning to you, Bob, and thank you for the great show that you have every week.
I appreciate you listening, and I appreciate you calling, and thank you for the compliment. I have as much fun with this as you do, so it works well for both of us.
Well, that's obvious. It really is. Well, so, Bob, I have a little gem magnolia that we planted last spring. Mm-hmm. It is about 12 feet tall.
Oh, wow. Nice tree.
About a 4-inch caliper on the trunk.
Okay.
And it is blooming like crazy, but what's bothering me about it is that it doesn't seem to be putting a lot of leaves on. Should I be worried about that?
No, you shouldn't be.
I can see all the way through the tree. It's
yep.
You know.
It's probably, you know, heavy blooming can be a sign of two things. Heavy blooming can either be a sign of a really healthy, happy plant, or it can be a plant that's under a little stress and it's saying, hey, I better bloom and make seed because I'm not doing so well. In the case of little gem magnolia, you know, keep in mind that it likes plenty of moisture. It likes relatively rich soil. It likes its root system to stay cool, which means leave the lower limbs on the tree and keep 2 or 3 inches of mulch over the root zone at all times. But magnolia, gosh, a little gem that says big after only a couple of years, that tree's doing well. The two things to watch for, you know, pay attention to the newest leaves. If you have burned tips or burned leaf margins, that's a sign that something's going on with the roots. But just a little thin, that doesn't really concern me. I probably would increase the fertilizing. I would increase the mulch and be sure that when you do water, that you really soak that soil thoroughly. You want that water way down into the soil because that tree has a fairly good root system, fairly deep root system too. So you're never going to water it adequately with a sprinkler. This is going to be something where you've got to get out, and when you water it, really, really, really soak it and then let it go till it's dry an inch or so deep and then do the process again.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that. And I've learned something that I'm going to have to do a little changing. So the information this morning has been very helpful. Thank you, Bob.
Well, very good. And keep in mind, all magnolias, this is true of, but little gem, that's probably your best choice for a magnolia in our part of the world. If you lived in Louisiana, now go ahead and plant the big old grandifloras. But if you've ever traveled, you know, through the South and just seen these magnificent trees, and you notice how the limbs are almost always way down to ground level, that's Mother Nature's way of keeping the roots cool. She wants that shade over the root zone, and unfortunately a lot of people will start trimming them up trying to make a shade tree out of them, and that's not what a magnolia is. But if you don't have a good lower limb structure shading the ground. It's you replace that with 2 inches of mulch year round, and you'll have a lot healthier tree for it. But sounds like you're off to a really good start there. I think you'll do very well with it, Joe.
Right. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
You do the same, sir. Thank you. All right, got to get a break in here, and then it's going to be Greg and John, and we move right on down the list. I get to talk about Nature's Creation, and I love Nature's Creation's products. They're a good company. They're natural on everything, fully organic on most things, and every week they tell me about one of their different products that they want to feature. This week, it's what they call their premium lawn and garden fertilizer, and it is a very, very good fertilizer for all sorts of uses, as the name suggests, lawns, gardens, trees, shrubs, and it is a non-manure-based fertilizer. It is based on alfalfa meal. There's so many different sources of nitrogen and other nutrients that go into different companies' fertilizers, and all the organic fertilizers are good, but the nice things about Nature's Creation product is being alfalfa-based, it's naturally slow-release. It can feed for up to 90 days, has absolutely no unpleasant odor to it. In fact, it really smells pretty good. Alfalfa is a wonderful product, and it never, ever burns. You can use it 365 days a year, wet, dry, hot, or cold. It's Nature's Creation's premium lawn and garden fertilizer. You complement that with their great compost, their great mulches. Oh, they make so many different fine products. It's just a great company with great products. You're going to find their things at a lot of different places. Landscape Solutions over in Castroville, Paradise Palms in New Braunfels, the Plant House up in Kerrville, Rainbow Gardens, both locations here in San Antonio, Earthworks over in Victoria. Lots of people carry quality products from Nature's Creation.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone lines. It's going to be, well, Greg and John are my next two callers, and first up is Greg. Good morning, Greg.
Morning.
Morning, sir.
Hey, I was curious, how long do you have to wait before I decide it's time to replace a plumbago that hadn't popped back up yet? I've got half a dozen that have not come up yet. Is it just too soon?
Were they mulched through the winter months?
A little bit. They're only a year old, but, you know, we had that snap of warm, kind of a week of warm weather in early part of March.
Right.
And I've got a couple others in other areas that have started to come up. Then we've had that cold snap, you know, a couple weeks ago, and they kind of stopped. And mm-hmm. I don't know if they're going to start again. I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
Cause they started,
yeah.
But I've got a half a dozen that never started.
I would give them till Easter, which is a week from tomorrow. And by that time, well, you know, we're going to have three very warm days if you count today as the first day. And then we're going to go back to some very moderate temperatures. But I think that on plumbago, if they're not sprouted in the next week, they're probably not going to. Now, there's some things like firebush that, no, it may be a month before they come up if the weather stays cool. But I give your plumbago another week. I would water really thoroughly when you water, and do fertilize as well. Dry fertilizer is fine, but liquid fertilizer works faster. I would get something like the Has to Grow plant formula. And I would feed both your ones that are just starting to come out and your ones that we're still hoping they are going to come out, because what they need warmth, they need water, they need food. And if they're not out by a week from Monday, it's probably time to think about planting some new ones.
What about the Prada Barbados? Are they the same weight, or do they need more heat?
They are heat lovers, but... And, yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because thinking about mine are barely starting to show. So I'm probably going to give Prada Barbados till tax day, till about April 15th. And if it's not back by then, the problem was the cold that we had this year back in December followed some very warm weather. The cold we had in 2021, which was actually much colder, the weather was kind of cooling down gradually. And we've seen plants damaged this year that weren't damaged in 21, even though the temperature was much colder then. So, and a lot of the tropicals, like the Pride of Barbados, like the Esperanzas, like that whole group of plants, some of them took it a lot harder. I'm going to give the Pride of Barbados probably about two more weeks. And did yours bloom well last summer?
Excellent, yeah. Okay. They all looked great.
Yeah, you probably made plenty of seeds. So even if the big plant doesn't come back, I would not be at all surprised if you don't have some new plants starting to come back around. So certainly not time to push the panic button yet, but I'd give them a couple of weeks before I say, okay, he didn't make it, time for more.
All right, well, biggest thing was those daggum plumbagos, but we'll see what happens. I'll give them another week.
Yeah, I give them another week. And are they the blue or the white form?
They're blue. And yeah, they look great.
Yeah, the blues I think are a little hardier than the whites, but both of them are good plants. It's just, you know, this year was tough because it was very warm, very dry, and then suddenly extremely cold. So things that don't normally suffered this year. And I've seen a little bit of plumbago that probably is dead, but most of it's just struggling along, kind of limping back. Be feeding it probably every 10 days or so with something like your has to grow plant, and that'll get them back growing much more quickly. Now, like I say, if the weathermen are accurate, it looks like next week we're going to start out warm, but it's going to be a very, very cool week with highs only in the 60s several days. So don't expect things to be growing too rapidly. It's acting like, as they always talk about, our traditional Easter cold spell. Then it looks like, as usual, we're going to get some much cooler weather than we sometimes do this part of April. So don't be in too much of a hurry. Just water and fertilize appropriately, and it'll be hot soon enough.
Okie dokie, thanks.
You're certainly welcome. Next in line is John. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks.
Good morning, sir. Well, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I need a lesson in potato grow, and I planted a redskin potato, and then I planted a Kennebec, and you know they both have come up beautifully. I haven't grown potatoes in a while. I grow all other vegetables, but
right.
I keep reading about hilling. Can you just give me some lessons on what I should expect from these things?
Well, it's a great question. And potatoes are easy. Potatoes are fun. And there are not a lot of real hard and fast rules, because one thing about this kind of potato, they make their potatoes right at the base of the plant. It's not like a sweet potato where the tubers may form 6 feet away from the plant. And you can harvest a potato at any point. A potato doesn't ripen per se. The potatoes get bigger and bigger and bigger until the soil gets really hot. So a couple of things you can do, and you planted yours back in February?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You can start kind of probing in the ground around the base of the plants with your index finger. And you probably will start finding a bunch of little potatoes that are at this point probably the size of ping pong balls. If you love new potatoes, you can go ahead and pop a few of those out of the ground. I wouldn't take all of them, but they're going to produce a number of potatoes up closer to the surface of the soil, and you can start harvesting at any point, and you're going to have some really good eating. Now, the thing about banking the soil up around the plants, I've not found that it really increases potato production. Maybe it helps the plants stand up a little bit better. But the one thing about the really shallow potatoes that form, if they're actually at the surface of the ground, if they get sunlight, then they start developing chlorophyll. They start developing the green pigment in the potato itself, which basically ruins the potato. So that's the one thing. The way I grow them is I would say I do more mulching than what they call banking the soil up. But you do whatever you like. But the main thing that you're doing by doing that is just ensuring that the potatoes that are close to the ground will continue to develop well. They will not start getting the chlorophyll. And like I say, if you want to leave them until the tops start to fall over in the fall, or not in the fall, but in the early summer months, typically in June, the tops start to fall over. But, and at that point, they've done about all they're going to do, and they're pretty much all ready for harvest. But that's the only purpose of kind of banking things up. If you want to start harvesting some of the little potatoes from around the base, have at it. If you would prefer just to wait and have all larger tomatoes, then just fertilize, water, and wait a while.
So they won't grow any more potatoes on those stems that I'm covering by doing the banking.
Oh, right? No. No, they don't. The potatoes are strictly going to form on the roots.
And do they, so the roots, so where I planted that piece of potato, the roots will take off from that, and then the potatoes they'll grow underneath where I planted. I guess I feared I planted them not deep enough. So is it best to plant them really deep or shallow?
Plant them relatively shallow. Plant mine probably with no more than an inch of soil over the top. Now, you go further north, they plant them deeper because there's one thing about potatoes. Sometimes we get a late frost that freezes them back, but then they just come right back out. If you were up north where freezing back takes on a whole new meaning because they get so much colder, then planting them deeper is probably a good idea. But mine, I've generally got no more than an inch of soil over the top of the little cut piece of potato. So you're doing fine. You planted them plenty deeply. Just be sure that you've got the surface of the ground right at the base of the plants covered with mulch, covered with something that's going to keep sunlight from hitting the little developing potato, because they're always going to start out below the surface of the ground. But if that potato starts developing an inch down, as it grows bigger, it's going to grow toward the top as well as toward the bottom. And first thing you know, the edge of the potato is up at the surface of the ground where it can start getting that sunlight, where it can start getting the green pigment developed. So a minute ago, we were talking about magnolias and the importance of keeping the mulch over the ground to protect the temperature. In this case, the mulching is important just to keep the sunlight from hitting the little potatoes. Now, some of the potatoes are going to be down directly underneath the little chunk of potato that you planted, and those, you're not going to have to worry about those at all. And I'll just tell you, in my own garden, what I usually do is continue to harvest and eat some of the smaller potatoes that are developed toward the surface, and then I leave the 3 to 5 big potatoes developed at the base until they are pretty much full size. If you planted a lot of potatoes, you know, some store better than others. But if you have enough that you plan on storing them for any length of time, when the top of the potato starts to yellow, starts to fade, starts to look like it's dying back, at that point you can go ahead and cut it off, but leave the potatoes in the ground about 2 weeks afterwards. That's going to toughen the skins on them to where they will keep better. But if you plan to harvest and use them fairly quickly, no, let them grow until the tops start to die, and then go ahead and just do all your digging. I store mine. I've got some of the old plastic containers are used to deliver soft drinks and milk and things like that in, and I can stack those little trays one on top of the other, and you always want to have good air circulation all around your potatoes. But if you get enough that you're going to be storing them for any length of time, you want to keep them relatively cool, and you want to not stack them on top of each other. You want to have good air circulation around the potatoes. Do that, they'll keep for at least a couple of months for you.
Great. Yeah, I grew up with grandparents who they grew everything they ate, and my
right.
granddad had a wire shelf in his shed that he stored them on every year, and lots of circulation, and they lasted well. One more question about okra. So I planted my okra early this year for reasons I won't go into, and within 4 or 5 days it was up and growing. However, they seem to have maybe a fungus. Is okra susceptible to fungus, or is it just these cool nights? Why is it looking yellow and maybe the leaves don't look great? Is there anything?
Well, my opinion, you planted way too early. Okra is an African plant that loves hot, hot, hot weather. And its growth is going to be stunted by, and it gets chilly below, 60 degrees. So I generally don't recommend planting okra until probably the 1st of May. Now, your plants that are up, when the weather gets hot, they're going to start flourishing much more. As far as fungal problems, yes, okra can get a very serious root fungus called cottony root rot. Not real common, but there's a product out there, a little hard to find right now, called Actinovate. And if you plant too early, again, you are more likely to have problems with fungi on the roots. But at this point, I would water, I would fertilize, and we're just going to have to wait for hotter weather before they're really going to start to do much for you. What you're describing to me is very typical for okra. They got planted while it was still a little too cool.
I understand. Okay, well, listen, thanks for the advice. I really appreciate it. Have a great
day. You do the same, but one more thing. When the 1st of May rolls around, if your plants aren't looking good at that point, plant some more. I mean, it's never too late to plant okra. You could plant okra as late as the 1st of July and still get a pretty good crop before it got too cool. So do everything you can to support these plants that are up and struggling, because we're going to have a couple of hot days, then it's going to be pretty chilly again toward the end of next week if the weathermen are right. So just watch them. Feed them. Take the best care of them you can. And if they're not looking good by around the 1st of May, just plant them, putting some more seed in the ground. It's cheap and easy.
All right. I got a jug of Has to Grow that's doing no good on the shelf, so I'll get out there.
Good plan. Yeah. Yes, good plan. You get out and enjoy. I appreciate the call this morning.
Thank you, Bob. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. Thank you. All right, need to take a quick break here and talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center. Big day going on over at Fanix. This is their annual grafting seminar. Starts about 9, goes on till noon, and they're going to cover, all types of grafting, from cleft grafting to budding to patch grafting. There are many, many different forms of grafting, and they've got a good expert over there to give you the lessons that you need if you're interested in doing any grafting. There's a second big thing going on over there. Well, actually, two more things. First of all, the Ego lithium-ion battery-powered equipment that I tell you about, all of their Ego equipment is 10% off this weekend, and today there will be reps from the Ego company there to demonstrate the equipment and answer all your questions about it. So if you've thought about getting away from gasoline engines and going to a totally different system, let me tell you, this lithium-ion battery-powered equipment is absolutely amazing. I was out with my line trimmer yesterday evening, and just amazing the power that these new battery-powered equipment, the power that the different tools have. But anyway, today their rep's going to be there, and they're going to be giving you 10% off on all the equipment. And plus, between 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock, there are going to be some folks from the Rose Society there to answer all your questions about roses. And, of course, Fanix is well-stocked on roses, on fruit trees, and on Eco lithium-ion battery-powered equipment, so it's a great day to go see them. Over on Home Green Road, where they've been for over 85 years now, you can check them out online. Get more information, simply go to Fanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, FanixNursery.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right, let's get back to gardening. Couple of open lines. Grab one if you like. It's going to be Bob and Kathy, and then you could be up next. You know the number, 210-599-5555. We say good morning to a man with a very good name. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, Bob.
Good morning, sir.
Been a while since I called in. I hope you are doing well.
You know, life is good, and we're just moving into one of the prettiest seasons of the year. So, yeah, only thing I complain about is spending too many hours working and not enough hours fishing. But, nobody listens, so I'll just go on smiling.
And that's the truth. Hey, I have one question concerning a situation that has developed in our neighborhood. It doesn't have anything to do with me, at least at the present time, but we've got a couple of neighbors. One of them, I think, is new to the area.
Uh-huh.
They've had some people come in and top out oak trees.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
is that something that's bound to kill those well-established trees?
It's just a sign of pure stupidity, but it won't long-term affect the health of the trees. It'll take away from that beautiful, majestic shape. And, you know, there's if you're going to top a tree, you might as well cut it off at ground level, in my opinion. I truly don't understand. If you need to reduce the size of something, you simply take those major branches, follow them down to where there's another branch growing the right direction, and cut them back to that point. But a mature oak like that, I can't imagine any reason. Now, we did have, you know, there are places that we had storm damage, and it's possible that you had limbs that split and broke, even though they didn't come crashing all the way down with that ice storm we had a month or so ago. So I guess I won't be too hard on them, not knowing exactly what the reason is. But unless there is severe damage, there is never any reason to do that with an oak tree, young or old. Now, young trees, the one other thing we do is go in, and where there are very narrow angle crotches, we'll usually prune out one half of that, because that's a very weak joint and is probably going to split someday. But again, we don't let the trees become mature trees before we do that. Sometimes we cable, sometimes we brace, we do a lot of different things, but it's not going to kill the tree, but it certainly does ruin the shape. And the reason I say it's not going to kill the tree is because I see trees get butchered all the time by these companies that come out and, you know, trim them around the power lines and things like that. And those trees survive. They're just kind of ugly looking from that point on. So, sure. Who knows what makes people do the things they do, but no, the trees are going to grow, and if they just leave them alone, they will gradually come back and, you know, assume a good shape again.
Okay. Well, I was just curious. I'd seen a lot of trees, like you say, topped out, but not oaks.
Yeah. But it's no tree benefits from being topped like that. We see people do it. Arizona ash is probably the most common things. And once again, I think you might as well cut it off at ground level. Now, it is possible, because we did see a lot of damage, you know, from the ice storm, not only on evergreen trees like oaks, but even deciduous trees. I had some big limbs come out of some of my pecan trees, but nothing really, really major. So maybe there's a reason for it. I, like you, have my doubts. And another of my big concerns here is that hopefully, if they made any major cuts, that they did seal the wounds, because that's how oak wilt gets started, and that's how power companies brought a lot of oak wilt into the area, and they got a lot of lawsuits a few years ago before they knew what was going on. But it shouldn't impact your trees, but again, you just kind of have to scratch your head and wonder why. And there's just an awful lot of people that claim that it's artistic to go in there and do that, but I don't agree with that in any way, form, or fashion.
Well, I think it was purely cosmetic, and again, they didn't, as far as I could tell, didn't treat them either. So, you know, that was my biggest concern, is that it would start something bad happening across the area.
And it's always possible. I guess the good news is that the drought and all has not been real conducive to the formation of the spore mats, which is where the disease-causing organism gets started. And we've had a year that fortunately wasn't real conducive to the spread of oak wilt, but it's always a possibility. And, what can I say? Stupidity is a very common thing in today's world, but don't get me started on that subject. Another of my favorite many expressions is, you know, I think there are really only two normal people in the world, you and me, and lately I'm not sure about you. Do your part as best you can, and just kind of, if people ask you, you know, tell them the reasons that it's a bad idea and that it doesn't really accomplish anything, and get the name of the companies doing it, because you want to make a big X next to them in the whatever, and be certain that, you know, you and your friends never call them, because anybody that would recommend that to a perfectly healthy oak tree is way off base, in my opinion.
Yeah, pretty questionable. I, on another topic, have, well, we live on top of caliche and a lot of limestone, and had to prepare raised beds, you know, over long term now, to kind of counteract the what appears to be cotton root rot working in the soil. I just wondered, because I'm seeing the particularly the summer vegetables almost getting stunted anymore. Over the years, they've become less hardy and less tall and less productive. Will that cotton root rot eventually infiltrate a raised bed?
Not normally, and recognize that cotton root rot only hits certain plants, mainly members of the cotton family. And the only vegetable plant that really falls into that is okra. So there are, you know, there's a lot of white fungal material in the soil that is actually beneficial. So seeing white filamentous material in the soil is not necessarily a bad sign. If things are not thriving, it usually is either the soil's become too compacted, or that just there's not enough nutrient material in the soil. And to some extent, it has been weather. Now, last summer, I knew very few people, though very few people, that grew a decent tomato crop. In fact, across the board, I'd say over 90% of the people that I talked to said that last year was the worst year for vegetable gardening that they've ever seen. And it was a combination of severe cold the year before, intense, extreme heat that started early and lasted through the summer. So part of what you're seeing is totally nature caused. So just, you know, stay organic. If you want to do things to improve the soil, put out molasses in any form, liquid or dry, and this stimulates microbial life, which is what improves the soil texture. I love this product called Azomite. It's a mineral ore, and it is probably the single best source I know of to be sure that all the micronutrients, the boron, the zinc, the iron, the molybdenum, the manganese, all those things that your plants need in very small quantities, it's a great source of that. And be sure that you're fertilizing regularly. Your garden should become more productive over the years, unless we have some real weather abnormalities, and we've certainly had that the past couple of years. So don't judge too harshly. Part of it may be Mother Nature rather than anything that we've done or failed to do.
Okay. Well, that sounds encouraging. And kind of the last topic for the morning is I've got a rental house where the tenants that are no longer there decided that they could use the front yard as their parking lot.
Uh-huh.
So I need to, I think that's illegal in San Antonio, but hey, it happens.
Yeah, don't get me started on bad taste.
Right. Anyhow,
but you want to restore it.
Yes, I want to restore it. I want to do it with Bermuda. That seems to be something that grows pretty well other places in their yard.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a large plot, but it's probably more than I want to do with anything but trying Bermuda seed.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that's feasible, and how do I prepare the ground before I do that?
Well, first of all, Bermuda seed is great as long as it's good and sunny, but it's too early to be putting Bermuda seed out. Bermuda is a hot weather grass, not a warm weather grass, and you're throwing your money away to plant Bermuda seed before probably the 1st of May. And so the good news is that you've got time to do some other things to work on compaction. I would be treating that area with molasses, either liquid or dry. I would, if possible, I'd be putting about 1/2 inch of compost over that area, watering it periodically just to get, that'll start the soil softening process. And then, you know, 6 weeks from now, let's see, looking at the calendar, April, well, maybe 4 or 5 weeks from now when we get up toward the 1st of May and get up toward Bermuda planting season, if you'll do these things to kind of get the soil going a little bit better beforehand, then your Bermuda seed will grow and take off a whole lot faster. So don't be in a rush to plant, because your Bermuda is not going to sprout. It's not going to grow well until the weather really starts getting very warm. But use that time in the meantime, principally molasses and compost. If you want to go ahead and put down a good organic fertilizer, you can certainly do that as well. But the more we do to soften the soil and improve the microbial life, the better your Bermuda is going to grow and spread once you sprout it, or once you spread it.
Okay. I don't want to till the soil at all.
If you want to bring up every weed in the world, you can till it, but it really doesn't accomplish much. And Bermuda is one of those grasses that will grow almost anywhere. It'll grow, the looser the soil is, the better it will grow. That's why it grows so well in our vegetable gardens. But in my opinion, tilling is a big mistake. And the kind of lightweight tiller you're going to go out and rent is just going to, it's going to tear you up more than it's going to tear the ground out when it's gotten that compacted.
All righty. Well, that's good information, and I appreciate your help.
Well, those are good questions, Bob. I appreciate you called this morning. Get out and enjoy. And if you want more help and advice on getting it started when the 1st of May rolls around, you know where to call me back. I'll look forward to hearing from you.
Sounds good.
Thank you, sir. All right. Goodbye. All right, let's get a break in here. Kathy's going to be up in just a moment. But right now, I get to talk about Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. And once again, you know, there are few things in life that somebody's not doing a bad job of. And roofing is one of those things that I just scratch my head when I look at what some roofers do. And it's why so many people end up replacing their roofs over and over when we have some sort of weather event. And sure, maybe they gave you a guarantee. Maybe they're going to do the job. But wouldn't you rather have a roof on your home that's going to last for the life of your home, that doesn't need to be replaced? You need a roof from Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. Like Danny Bose over there says, do it once, do it for life. Their roofs are lifetime quality. They also do new construction. If you're building a new home, tell your builder you want Southwest Metal Roofing Systems to put the roof on it, because it's truly the last roof you will ever put on your home. It's the roof I have on my home, the roof we have here on Shades of Green, the roof my business partner, the roof they have over their heads. It's simply the best roof out there, and you don't have to worry about what the weather does. And, of course, you've got lots of choices. If you don't want just a look of shiny standing seam metal, which I love, which is here on Shades of Green, you can have a roof of a different color, like I have on my home up in the hill country. You can actually have a roof that doesn't even look like standing seam metal, that looks like slate or shaped shingles or several different other looks, but it's just still the same great quality, lifetime quality metal. Going to save you money on your energy bills because their roofs are so energy efficient. Many, if not most, homeowners insurance companies give you a discount when you have a Southwest Metal Roofing Systems roof on your home, like mine certainly does. I just love Southwest Metal Roofing Systems. Truly the last roof you'll ever put on your home, and very, very little more money than an old shingle roof that's going to be replaced just a few years down the road. Learn more. Give them a call. 210-822-6868. It's 210-822-6868.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening on this beautiful Saturday morning out there. Looks like it's going to be Kathy and Jerry and David. Kathy is up first. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning, Bob. I have several questions for you.
That's what I'm here for.
Great. I was looking at planting some flowers out front where it's very sunny. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in something that would tolerate the drought that we had last year. I know that plumbago did very well also mm-hmm. in the drought. And I was wondering about that firecracker plant. How would that work?
It will work fine. Now, keep in mind that these plants are drought tolerant once they are established, once they've gotten their roots started. So you're going to have to take pretty good care of them to get that root system down and well spread, and after that, that is when they will be drought resistant, whether it's plumbago, whether it's firecracker, whether it's salvias of many different sources. But yes, the so-called firecracker, properly called Roselia, it's a beautiful plant. The hummingbirds love it. It's normally evergreen. And, you know, like I say, once established, it is certainly as drought tolerant as plumbago is. Now, other things you might consider, some of the salvias, especially the evergreen ones like Salvia greggii, are very drought tolerant. There's a little low white flower called Blackfoot Daisy, very drought tolerant. There is a beautiful plant called Pink Skullcap, very drought tolerant. There are lots of different things. There's no reason to have a drab yard just because it's hot and dry. There are a lot of things that will thrive in those conditions, and you're just working and finding them.
Okay, thank you. And someone that I know has made a greenhouse with polycarbonate.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to know, how does that work? Like, I know she said that she put stuff in there and it was too hot for it. And mm-hmm. So do you have to have that air conditioned here or what? How does that work?
Well, in anything that is closed up in the Texas sun is going to be hot. I mean, look at a car you leave parked on the parking lot with the windows up. It's going to be 160, 180 degrees inside when you go back to get in your car. And a greenhouse is exactly the same way. It's called the greenhouse effect. And polycarbonates, there are good ones and there are bad ones, but there are a lot of semi-clear roofing materials made of a polycarbonate material and used for greenhouses. Now, if you're going to, in effect, leave your greenhouse closed through the summer months, you do have to provide some sort of cooling. And when we say air conditioning, that implies refrigerated air, and that's not a practical way to cool a greenhouse. But a greenhouse of any size is usually, we put up what's called a wet wall. We use evaporative cooling. We have one wall that we trickle water through, and then we have an exhaust fan on the other end of the greenhouse that pulls the air in. As it does so, it evaporates the water, which cools the air. So many people, no fashion word for it, was a swamp cooler. And in a small greenhouse, it's a unit you just put on one wall and have it blow cooler air into the greenhouse. Bigger greenhouse, you put your fans on one wall and your wet wall on the opposite side of the greenhouse. Other people, which is basically what we do here at our nursery, is we build our greenhouses so that we can take the sides off in the summer months and just have natural air flow through there. And it certainly gets warm, but it doesn't get that much warmer than what the outside temperature is. So polycarbonate is a good material for making a greenhouse roof, but you would be facing the same issues if you use glass or if you use any other product. It's just kind of, we build greenhouses a little bit differently in the South than we do in much cooler climates. Now, the other thing we do to mitigate the sun's energy is we put what is simply called shade cloth over the roof of a greenhouse structure, and there are many different kinds of shade cloth. There's woven, there's knit. Most of them are made out of some sort of polypropylene material. There's a new one out there called Aluminet, which actually reflects a lot of the heat energy away from the greenhouse. So we can reduce the temperature in the greenhouse several degrees just by putting the appropriate shade cloth over the top. But there are just a lot of things to know. I love greenhouses. I have a greenhouse at home myself, and, of course, we have big greenhouses here at our nursery. But there's a lot to know about constructing them and also maintaining them. So it's a great question and one that doesn't have just one simple answer.
Okay. Thank you. And then my last question is, I heard you talking to someone about using molasses as a fertilizer.
Well, not so much as a fertilizer. Yeah, it's not really a fertilizer. It doesn't have a lot of nitrogen or phosphorus in it, but it is a microbial stimulant, which really stimulates the beneficial life that's in the soil. So we usually use molasses, as a supplement. Now, on hay fields and things like that, we use a special form of molasses that has urea, that has nitrogen added to it. But as homeowners, we're using molasses not so much as a fertilizer, but as a stimulant for the life that's in the soil.
Okay. So I have a gallon of molasses, but it's kind of gotten thick.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still good?
Absolutely. Has a shelf life of probably 40 years.
Okay, so just add it to water.
Yeah, the rate is usually 1 to 2 tablespoons per gallon of water. You can spray it on, you can pour it on, whatever works for you. You will see a product called dry molasses, and it's a totally different material. It's molasses. It's not crystalline molasses. It doesn't dissolve. It's just molasses that has been soaked into some sort of substrate so that it's more granular in nature, and you can just sling it around by hand. But your gallon of molasses, no, it doesn't go bad. Dilute it with water, 1 to 2 tablespoons per gallon, and it's fine on virtually everything that grows. And even on bare soil, it'll work to soften the soil and get the microbes built up in there that are what really make your soil soft over long term.
Okay. And then I heard you talking about someone that had strawberries that they should put sluggo around it. Now,
yeah.
Should you be using sluggo like in your raised beds for your vegetables? Is that something
you
do on a regular basis here in San Antonio?
If you have a problem with snails or slugs or pill bugs, then sluggo is probably your best choice for something that safely kills all of those. If you don't have a problem with snails or slugs or pill bugs, don't waste your money putting it out. But if any of those three critters are harming your garden, sluggo is inexpensive, totally safe for people and pets, and very, very effective. It's an iron phosphate bait, and then in the sluggo plus, which is what it takes to get the pill bugs, they add a little bit of spinosad to it. But it's an excellent product if you need it.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay.
Well, you're certainly welcome. Really good questions, Kathy. I certainly appreciate the call. Thank you. Okay,
thank you.
Goodbye. All right, need to get a break in here, and I get to talk about Rhonda's Nature's Way. Again, we talk about plant health all the time. Dr. Kirby and I talk about pet health on Sunday mornings, but what about your health? Rhonda's Nature's Way is just, well, it's a store where you're going to find all sorts of things that will help you feel better and live better naturally. You know, there are a lot of solutions to the problems that all of us face periodically, whether it's sleep issues, digestive issues, mood issues. You can always run to the doctor for some pharmaceutical product that treats the symptoms. Well, Rhonda really wants to help get your body stronger, wants you to get natural solutions to these problems because her products don't have side effects. You know, when you look at her, when you hear the commercials that run on this show for pharmaceuticals and the side effects are longer than the benefits, hey, that's not what I'm going to put in my body. I visit Rhonda's regularly. I take a good immune support supplement. I get the electrolyte solution that I mix with water to drink during the summer just to keep going when it gets really hot. Rhonda has the best in vitamins and you know, again, great natural supplements. Best of all, she and her staff have the knowledge that you only get from being in business over 40 years. She can help you with whatever issues may be bothering you. Pain, for instance, there's a wonderful product, curcumin-based product that she carries. Rhonda's Nature's Way is a wonderful place if you want to feel better naturally. And if you're trying to lose some weight, well, she's got products that have that good sweet flavor but don't have the refined sugars and you know, all those things that so much of the candies and cakes and things have, but you still get to keep some good sweet in your diet. Things that are sweetened with monk fruit, some incredible chocolate. Oh, I could go on and on about that. She also does a couple of therapies, the Beamer light therapy, the red light therapy, and, of course, reflexology. Just a wonderful place to know about it. It's called Rhonda's Nature's Way. She's open Monday through Saturday, always closed on Sunday, over in the shopping center at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. If you want a wonderful experience and if you want to simply live better naturally, you go see our friends at Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Couple of open phone lines out there, but we're going to talk to Jerry and David first. Jerry is up first. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
How are you doing? Really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure.
They were talking about potatoes earlier.
Yeah.
I've got a small raised bed, about 2 by 8 foot, but I've crowded them in there pretty tight, and I was wanting to split them up, but they've been in the ground for about a month, maybe almost 5 weeks now.
Let them go. Yeah, let them go. You can't move them at this point, but it doesn't really hurt them to be crowded. I mean, when I plant mine, I probably plant them no more than 6 or 8 inches apart, and they still produce just fine. I mean, the top of the plant doesn't really matter as long as it's getting good sunlight. I guess it's possible that if they were really crowded, you could have an issue with the plants individually not getting enough sunshine, but not going to be a big issue. Potatoes are one of the easiest things to grow. Now, some people grow them better than others, but I sure wouldn't go back and try to redo anything. You'll end up doing a lot more damage than good.
How about if I add a couple of inches of good garden soil to the top of them?
That's fine. That's fine. They call that banking, and a lot of when you go up north, they consider it just an important practice when it comes to growing potatoes. I don't know if you heard my caller earlier, but as I was explaining to him, the main thing that goes wrong with some of the potatoes is potatoes develop very close to the surface of the ground. And if the top of that potato is actually up where the sunlight hits it, it starts forming green pigment, starts forming chlorophyll, which basically ruins the potato. So adding some, you know, an inch or two of soil to the top is going to stop that from happening. And in this case, plants are going to die anyway when hot weather gets here. So there are really no negatives to it. If you want to go in and bank them up with a couple of inches of good soil, go for it. It's not going to cause any problems, and it's going to prevent some problems, too.
Well, this would be an actual, like, a layer, like 2 inches or 3 inches on top.
Mm-hmm. Do you have your potatoes planted in rows?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I wouldn't, you know, the little walkway you have between the rows, don't add 2 inches of soil there. But over right. the surface of the soil around the base of the plants and actually banked up against the, you know, the lower part of the plant itself, no, that's not going to harm a thing.
Okay. The potatoes won't be migrating up. They're going to stay where they're already growing, correct?
Well, yeah, the potatoes are going to stay where they are, but keep in mind, if a plant grows 2 inches in diameter, 1 inch is going to be up, 1 inch is going to be down. The whole yep. potato is not going to move, but the top part of that potato is naturally going to get closer to the surface of the soil just because the potato is growing in diameter. But also keep in mind, too, that at any point that you want to, you can start probing around with your finger in the soil at the base of the plant. And once your potatoes get up to, you know, being ping pong ball or golf ball size, you don't have to let them mature. They don't ripen per se. And a little young potato, new potatoes as we call them, is just as delicious as a big baking potato, just a little bit different texture.
Yes, sir. One other question. I would like to plant some bush beans in mm-hmm. another raised bed close to there, but I'm worried about an inoculant. What is an inoculant exactly, and where would I get it?
An inoculant, well, let's talk about what beans are. Beans are in a group of plants that we call legumes. They have little structures, kind of like a little BB, like the size of number 7 buckshot probably. These little things form on the roots. It's not like a root knot nematode that causes a deformed root, but you'll have these little balls form associated with the roots, and they have a bacteria inside of them which is able to take nitrogen from the air and convert it into fertilizer. That's why beans and peas and other legumes are said to build the soil, is because they're actually harvesting material from the air and making fertilizer, as it were, you know, in around their own root system. So when you inoculate the seed, what you're doing is simply bringing in some of these bacteria, which would do the actual process of taking nitrogen from the air and turning it into fertilizer. Now, once you have planted beans in a given area, you don't have to re-inoculate. If you inoculate once, then, you know, they will stay in the soil from season to season. Now, if you move your row of beans, you know, 10 feet over to the other side of the garden, yeah, you're going to have to inoculate that area at some point. But even without the inoculants, your beans will still produce plenty of good beans. And you will normally find the inoculant at nurseries and garden centers. It's been in very short supply this year. It's been very hard to come by. But it doesn't mean that you can't plant beans. And I guess you could probably go online. But what you're looking for is just, and it's, you know, an inoculant can be a lot of different things. But what you are looking for is specifically a legume inoculant. And all it's doing is sort of enabling the plants to make some of their own fertilizer. It's not mandatory. You'll grow good beans without it. You'll just grow a little bit better beans with it.
Okay, and is there a name I'll be looking for, or a
it goes by so many different names. There's one brand called Nitrogen, G-I-N. I wouldn't worry about the name. What you're looking for is just a bean and pea, or just a legume inoculant.
Okay, sir. All right, sir.
Good question. Very good question.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Really enjoy your program and really learn a lot from it, sir.
Well, that's my purpose in being here, Jerry. I appreciate the compliment and the call. You get out and have a good weekend, and looks like I better get my last break of the hour in, and then we will talk to David. Looks like I get to talk to you about Window Source. And let me tell you, it's just fun when you meet somebody that has a passion for their work, that is very, very good at what they're doing, and just determined to be the very best in the industry. And that's the way Moses is. It was just so nice to meet and talk and get to know him and find out what makes his company really special. Their windows, their doors are made right here in Texas, absolute top quality. He's got a lot of experience, 10 years in the industry, 5 years of owning his own business. He said, out to be the best, and I tell you, he's won just about every award that a person could win, and it's for a lot of different reasons. Now, most companies, they're going to give you what they call a warranty, but how many people have actually read that warranty to see what it covers and what it doesn't? Well, most window companies, your warranty is not going to cover labor, which can be quite expensive, not going to cover glass breakage. Well, once again, Moses said, my warranty is a true quality warranty, and it covers labor, and it covers glass breakage. So you know that when he does your installation, it does it for life. Top quality, wonderful warranty, wonderful workmanship, years of experience. If you're thinking of new doors or windows, I strongly suggest you talk to Moses and his good folks before you proceed, because chances are you're going to find they're going to give you a wonderful deal and a much better warranty than you're going to get most other places. Remember the name, Window Source, Window Source of Texas. Their offices are located over on the southwest side of town. Their phone number, this is important, 210-871-9003, 210-871-9003. If you're thinking of new windows or doors, don't proceed until you've talked to the Window Source.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening on what's going to be a really nice Saturday out there. Great day for gardening. Going to get a little warm this afternoon. If you're out working hard, be sure you're drinking plenty of fluids. Be sure you're getting plenty of electrolytes in your system. I love that product called Ultima. It's doesn't have sugar in it, but it's got all the other electrolytes you need. Nothing of artificial in there, but. And just a lot of folks overdue when we get that first really pretty day to get out and work hard in the yard. If you're one of those overdoers, just be sure you stay well hydrated. Next in line is David. Good morning, David.
Hey, Bob. How's it going?
Hey, it's off to a good start. Going to be a wonderful day.
Hey, are our ash junipers native?
Yes. Yes, ash junipers did not used to be the problem that they were because periodically, you know, we had fire. And fire tended to burn them off. The whole hill country used to burn periodically. And the ash junipers, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, were confined mainly to canyons and, much more limited areas. But then when the sheep farmers came through and, destroyed the vegetation, we started losing the soil. When we stopped letting fires burn, they're so successful at reproducing and all that they kind of became the scourge of the hill country and certainly are the dominant plant in a lot of the area. But, they've been here forever. They just haven't been the problem that they are today.
Wow. So everything else has changed, not them.
Well, it's just unfortunately, and, I guess they had their place. I don't know what the early indigenous people, what all they did with them. I know you get down, Dr. Kirby has recovered some artifacts from some caves on property that he owns down there, and they used to make sotol leaves and things like that for making baskets, and they used a lot of different native things, and I'm not sure what the native junipers were used for in the grand scheme of things, but they've been around here for longer than people have.
Wow. I tell you, I live in the Guadalupe Valley, and our only big problem here is when Pernellas Electric Co-op turns our electricity off, and everything I've got's electric.
My wife's
got a greenhouse with about 100 orchids in it, and I'm out there building fires and barbecue pits and blow torches, everything, trying to keep them from getting killed.
Well, you bring up some real interesting points, and I've got about 3 minutes here before we'll talk to Howard. But one thing that you can do if you have open space under the benches, put some sort of water trough in there. Obviously put some little gambusia, mosquito fish or something like that in there. But old Malcolm Beck had some big troughs in the little greenhouse he had, and it's like a heat sink. That water warms up enough during the day, and then that heat radiates back out at night. And Malcolm never even had a heater in his greenhouse, but I guess he probably didn't have the really severe cold, but it's amazing. And he actually raised fish, his. But you can create a heat sink like that. There's a lot to be said for solar energy. There with a lot of companies that aren't real good. There are some of them that are very good that you can actually store some of that energy and use to keep your greenhouse warm. There are a couple of new propane heaters out there. In fact, there's one that even is acceptable for use indoors. My business partner found one of these online. I don't remember the name, Mr. Heater or something like that, but we took it out for a fundraising thing called the Turkey Trot, and it was a cold day, and let me tell you, you wouldn't believe how many people were trying to cluster around that propane heater because it just works so efficiently and so safely. So yeah, I identify with you that either extreme cold or extreme heat are both really hard on greenhouses, but there are some fun and creative things you can do.
Yeah. Where are your orchids? Are you still selling and raising orchids?
No, the government put us out of business on that years ago when they started letting the people bring them in from overseas, from countries where the government subsidizes their orchid growers. But I still grow orchids for a hobby at home. We sell orchids, but mainly things we get out of California. If you're interested in a wide range of orchids, there's a neat place off of Wetmore Road called E.B. Huntington Orchids, and Liz O'Toole has that, and she has a tremendous selection of orchids if you're looking for a good orchid source, and also some other interesting tropicals.
Yeah, my wives are in bloom right now. And I mean, she's got 100 of them. It's just beautiful. You walk in there first thing in the morning when the sun first comes up, and the ones that really have a smell really almost knock you down.
I grow a lot of little what they call mini cats, smaller stature cattleyas that, the fragrance is just almost overwhelming on those things. So, yeah, it's a great hobby. It just happens to be highly addictive. But anyway, we'll talk again, and maybe But do look into heat sinks. That'll help in the winter months as well. Right now, it's just about time to talk to the Dirt Doctor here on KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
But if you've been listening very long, you know, don't dial right now. We'll save the last few minutes of the show for a few more phone calls. And then, of course, we have 3 hours that we do this tomorrow. But this is the time we set aside to visit every week with the Dirt Doctor, or just about every week. But what's going on this morning, Howard Garrett?
Well, we dodged a pretty rough storm yesterday that popped up down here. And other than that, the weather's been really beautiful. Spring is here.
It's just we're still short on rain, but boy, when it comes to just pretty days, it's been just really nice. And it's just yo-yo weather. I mean, at least here we're looking at temperatures approaching or into the low 90s today and tomorrow. And then when you get into next week, we're looking at days when the high is forecast to be in the low 60s. So it's been a very interesting year.
It has. I think it's time to plant, though. I don't think we're going to have – I'm predicting we're not going to have any more frost. So
yeah.
That's a smart thing to predict, but that's what I predict.
Well, I will agree with you. I'm doing the same, and I still think it's a little early on planting a couple of things. Okra is one of those vegetables that I love to grow, but I consider it not a warm weather plant, but a hot weather plant.
Yep,
and people that are wanting to plant Bermuda grass from seed, that's the other one that I tell people don't be in any hurry. But boy, just about everything else in the vegetable garden and most all flowers. I'm saying that it's even okay on, most likely okay on periwinkles. I always wait on those because of the problem with Phytophthora, but looks like we're consistently warm now, so no excuses for having a drab yard. There's too much beautiful stuff out there. And, you know, I was sitting here thinking about different things, and if you've got a particular topic you want to go into, that's fine. But probably one of the most common questions that I get is, what is this stuff called Garrett juice that you're forever talking about? Or so many people still confuse it and say carrot juice. But I thought it'd be fun if you take just a minute and talk about how you came up with the Garrett juice idea. Obviously, it's not a real specific formulation, but it's been such a wonderful product for so many uses. I thought it'd be fun just to talk about it for a few minutes.
Well, it just kind of evolved because when I was taught by various people how to do organic gardening, including Malcolm and John Dromgoole and a lot of people around the country, most people in those days were using a foliar spray of fish and seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was really only those two ingredients. And I can't remember when the molasses came into the picture. I don't know if Malcolm came up with that or who did, but at some point we all started seeing benefits from sugars being put in that fish and seaweed mixture, and specifically molasses, and then we all decided somehow or another that the best sugar was this molasses that was an agricultural product that was, you know, used in animal feeds and things, and
mm-hmm.
so it was available at feed stores and farm stores and that sort of thing. And we saw benefits from it. And I think during that time we also were experimenting with fire ant control, and we noticed that the sugar added to orange oil made the orange oil kill a little bit better on the fire ant things. And I think it was Malcolm that came up with the idea of adding compost to that mixture. Also made it work even better, made it last longer and more effective. So the liquid mixture just sort of started building itself organically. And then I was working with an arborist down in South Texas on Oakwell. He was mm-hmm. sharing some information with me, and I was talking to him about some of the things I was doing up here, and he was telling me he was having great luck using a fish and seaweed spray for the oak wilt control, and he discovered that if he put a material in it that lowered the pH, made it more acidic, that it made it work better. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And an easy way to do that with a more organic thing. He was using some kind of chemical acid that would lower it. And I figured, well, if I add molasses to it, that might work. And I did, and it was just remarkable how well it worked. And then I thought, well, why not just put all these things together and see how it works as a foliar feed? And I thought that the compost tea, the fish, and well, actually, the first Garrett juice didn't even have fish in it. It had just the seaweed in it and the molasses. It worked great. And then later on, we said, well, let's give it a little more horsepower by adding the fish. And that was the genesis of the product that Medina makes. It's called the Garrett Juice Plus, which is all the ingredients plus a little bit of fish.
And the apple cider vinegar,
Yeah, the vinegar was in it. And the vinegar seemed to make everything work better. It seemed to be a synergist in the product. And so we, you know, had a contest because I kept telling people to mix compost tea and vinegar and molasses and seaweed together just over and over and over. And finally one day I said, well, let's have a contest on the show and name this stuff. It didn't at that point have a name. And somebody recommended Garrett Juice. They were the winner. Some of my sponsors that have various products put up products and gave him gave that family some prizes. He allowed us to have the name. We protected the name, but we allowed two or three different companies to make a commercial version of it if they would agree to use the formula that we had come up with, vinegar, molasses, seaweed, and compost tea. And that's how it began, and then we started playing around with adding other things to it. Malcolm had actually, in the compost tea part of it, kind of accidentally added lava sand dust to it because he had it in the compost. He had the lava sand in the compost. So some people added that. Some people added a few other things, but basically the formula of the basic Garrett juice is the compost tea, vinegar, molasses, and seaweed. You add the fish to it, makes it more powerful. If you add microorganisms to it, it becomes the Garrett Juice Pro. And I warn people about using it if they're going to add hydrogen peroxide to it to try to kill some disease, because hydrogen peroxide might hurt the microbes in the product. But anyway, that's kind of the evolution of it. It just kind of grew organically. The commercial versions of it contain, rather than compost tea, liquid humate. And that happened because they discovered that it would be more consistent than compost tea. Even a good quality compost tea is going to vary from batch to batch. And so that's how it started being added to it. And lo and behold, that became a big pro part of Garrett juice because it would have detox ability. And so it became the easiest way for people to put out a fine textured humate as step one of the detox program. So Garrett juice is the main part of the basic organic program that I recommend, the detox program that I recommend, and also the sick tree treatment, mainly because it has that fine textured humate in it, but it's also because of the other things that are in it as well. You could soak any of the products that we talk about in water and strain out the solids and make them part of Garrett juice. Cornmeal, for example, or azomite, or any of the rock minerals that we recommend. You just can't leave the big particulate matter in there if you're going to be spraying it from sprayers that have pretty small nozzles.
And, of course, you know, some people, including me, put it on with the watering can, and that way you're not as worried about it. But, well, I knew a lot of that, but that there are a couple of things I didn't know about the in the overall evolution of it. But it just has so many different uses, and I just thought it'd be interesting for people to know how it got started, and people who don't want to buy it already branded and in a bottle, you've got virtually all that information on dirtdoctor.com, and people can certainly make their own. It's just more convenient to just simply go over and open the bottle and dilute it to the appropriate point and use it. But it has been a very interesting evolution, and it continues to evolve. And I know that when we took the course from Dr. Ingham a long time ago, she talked about making, in effect, designer compost teas, as she called them, to address different issues. And that's the same thing that we recommend that people can do with Garrett Juice, is depending on what you're doing, you can bump up some of the individual things, such as for spider mite control. I think making the liquid seaweed a little bit, you know, more concentrated there, and for you know, fire ant suppression, maybe making the molasses a little bit more concentrated in there. But that's the fun thing. It's like everything organic. It's not an exact thing, and you can vary it a little bit depending on what your needs are.
Well, one of the side benefits from it that I'm almost positive about is that you get pre-pest control from it. And mm-hmm. the reason is the fact that it has seaweed in it, but those other ingredients all working together do something pretty magical too. We thought at first it was just for foliar feeding, and then uh-huh. as we started watching how it performed, we realized that it functioned to actually prevent certain diseases and certain insects on property where we're spraying Garrett mm-hmm. juice on a regular basis. We just don't have insect and disease problems. And then we later discovered that it worked as a root stimulant better than anything on the market. And then we also started noticing that when we were having trouble with plants setting buds and blooming and flowering, using it as a spray and a drench, it helped that. And also we learned that, and you talk about this with just water, liquids mm-hmm. have the ability to go mm-hmm. into a plant through the, not just through the ground and the roots, but through the bark and the buds and the entire plant, and the Garrett juice goes in and functions as a fertilizer that way as well as in the ground. So it just continues to show us benefits across the board.
Well, and for so many different things. I know we use it as a pre-treatment, planting seeds of just about any source, as a sort of as a root stimulator. Right. And it's just interesting, but I have to say that's one question that just hardly a day goes by that somebody doesn't ask about. So anyway, thank you for enlightening us all, and you know, just getting into gardening season here, and following this crazy winter, and all our plants need all the help they can get. But I think it's important too, with most everything's coming back pretty strong, but there are a few of our perennials and things that are a little reluctant coming back. A few of the salvias, some of the plumbagos, some of the kufias are a little slow coming back, but I think it's a very good thing to be using there to help speed things up. But it's been an unusual year, and it's just good to have that.
Yeah, it's gotten so important for some people. There's a few landscape contractors that's their only fertilizer they're using, and I'm continuing to get reports from them about that. The convenience of it, and also just the efficacy, has been really good. Some people put out one dry fertilizer application a year. In fact, I recommend this on some of the ranches where I consult. One dry fertilizer application a year. If the budget allows it, one application of molasses, and then a regular spraying of Garrett juice. Now, the formula is always available to people to make it themselves. It's in my books. It's on dirtdoctor.com and everything else. But there are the commercial products if people want to go that route, up to and including totes. You can buy it in any size.
And there are people out there that use that kind of quantity, but it's just the thing I love about it, too, there are no negatives. You know, it's just you don't have to be real careful that it's not too hot or not too cold or not too, you know, wrong time of year or whatever. I haven't found any negatives to it in literally 365 days a year. Some times of year, it, of course, will have more benefits when things are in active growth. But as far as the detox program and all, it's something that can be done anytime without really looking at the weather or the calendar.
I'll tell you something else, and you've already referred to it today when I was listening as well, but I'm seeing something really interesting about this tree trunk goop formula that we came up with as mm-hmm. well. I told you about the Japanese maples that I designed into a commercial planting here last summer. They were mm-hmm. planted and they were stripped horribly badly by squirrels. It
yep.
was unreal. It would have killed them if nothing had been done.
Uh-huh.
And the only things I could come up with at the time I had in my garage that I gave to the owner is the mixture that I now recommend, the kale and clay,
mm-hmm.
the azomite and compost, and they did a good job of slathering it all over these little trees. And I noticed something just last week that I hadn't noticed before. Those wounds from last year have completely healed. There's no uncovered tissue left at all. The callusing formed and spread so fast in less than one growing season, it is just amazing. And one thing I sent you today was contact information about the company that sells kale and clay. And
okay.
I'm trying my best to get some smaller containers on the market. They gave us samples of kale and clay. It's Burgess Pigment Company is the name of the
uh-huh.
company. They gave us some 1 gallon samples. So
wow.
I'm going to check with them, and you might check with them, too. They might sell, you know, you, Chase Green, and other people the stuff in 5 gallon, not 5 gallon, 1 gallon containers.
Uh-huh.
Well, they have anything, probably, but it's as small, obviously, as 1 gallon, and it's one of the three ingredients in that mixture. And if you have any damage on any woody plants at all, it doesn't matter whether it's grapes or fig trees or any of your orchard trees are up to live oaks or whatever in between, putting this stuff on the wound is just incredible how it works.
Yeah. I suspect it would also be good for sun scald because we still see some of that where growers have simply grown the stuff too close together, or maybe it's been grown in too shady a situation, and that or even we see people out thinking they're doing the right thing in the hill country, clearing cedar, but they go in and they, on young trees, they cut all of that ash juniper growth that's on the west side of the tree, and those young trees that still have the smooth bark, they can actually sunburn, and it can be a real serious problem. So I would think that would be another very good thing to use it for.
It is. It won't last quite as long as paint. Now, in that
uh-huh.
situation, the latex paint may be a little better way to go. And
well,
you wouldn't have to mix anything.
Yeah, for prevention, I would totally agree. But after the damage has occurred, I think this has
yeah.
healing properties
right.
that the paint doesn't. So, just
yeah,
just,
and the kale and clay, if people were wondering about it, the kale and clay is the ingredient now that holds it on the trunk longer, and,
mm-hmm.
and that is one of the reasons why I thought about using it, because it works so well as a particle film, you know, to spray on plants to repel grasshoppers and other insects. That's how I came up with the idea to try it, and lo and behold, it really, really works well.
And well, and you just
brought...
Yeah. Well, you lucky people to get rain have that problem. We haven't had many things wash off lately down here. I'm hoping that will change, but That is the other thing I wanted to mention and ask about, because we have not been able to find a good source on the Nosema locustri bait for controlling grasshoppers. And you never know, but I suspect that this may be a bad year for grasshoppers, and that kaolin clay as a repellent to spray on the foliage that the grasshoppers want to chew on, it seems to be one of the best things we can do to stop grasshopper damage. And if we get an improved source on it, that's just going to make it all that much better.
Yeah, it just confuses them, and they stop feeding is how it works. The only thing you got to worry about a little bit is if you're in the business of selling produce, it is a cosmetic issue. Mm-hmm. It'll wash off, but it doesn't wash off easily. So that's the only thing to warn you about just a little bit. But it does work very, very well. The trunks of plants, you know, no problem at all. And if it washes off and goes into the ground around the plants, mm-hmm. that mixture is a pretty darn good fertilizer, so
really?
There's no problem there. Yeah, you just reapply it on the trunk after it gets washed off by irrigation or rain.
Well, then it's kind of a film, kind of a little bit of cloudiness, and like you say, it washes off. Nothing harmful is absorbed into the plants or into the vegetables in any way. So. It's you know, going to be interesting to see how things evolve this year. I've been kind of surprised. We're putting out a lot of trichogramma wasps for caterpillar control, but knock on wood, thus far, we're not seeing little gall worms and leaf rolling caterpillars that I was afraid we would see after a hard winter, because 2021, I think one thing we saw there was that the winter was bad enough that it set back the beneficial populations, and that allowed some of the other things to come on a little bit stronger. But I haven't seen any of that yet this year. I certainly hope that trend continues.
Well, I think the other ingredient in the tree trunk goop that's just remarkable is the azomite. I think it's mm-hmm. a big part of how quickly the wounds heal, because there's a lot of bioavailable nutrients, you've mentioned it today, in the azomite. So if people wonder if you've heard my formulas in the past, my formula has changed a lot on that. One of the last columns I did was on the sick tree treatment, the whole evolution of it, and it also happened kind of organically, and you can find it on dirtdoctor.com.
And that's the word I use, evolve. I use more than change, because I think it's continuously been made better and better by some of the things that you've done. So it's not only changed, it's really evolved, but it's an ongoing thing. Who knows, a year from now, 5 years from now, we may find other things that added to it, probably in fairly small quantities, may enhance the things it does even more. So just good stuff, and people that are trying to get over some winter damage, I think it could be a very important part of the program.
One of the things we're noticing across the board, and I'm really noticing it on my properties, we have no insect damage. We have no aphids. We have no spider mites. We have very few caterpillars. I'm having people send me a few photographs right now of forest tent caterpillars mm-hmm. that are all over the furniture and everything else, but we haven't seen any of that here, and I'm not seeing it on any of the projects that have been using some of the things that we're recommending. One of the things that azomite might be providing that kind of flies under the radar is silica, available silica.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we know that helps with squash vine borers and squash bugs and some, spotted cucumber beetles and some of the really tough to control things. So you got the Garrett juice functioning as a repellent, a non-killing pest control. We hate to say that, because it's not a pest control. It just indirectly benefits, because it makes the plants more healthy. But I think then the dry application of the things that we talk about, especially azomite, might be mm-hmm. what's really keeping those pests at bay.
Yeah. The one thing that we're a little concerned about is we are seeing June bugs like you wouldn't believe, the adult stage of the grub worms, and I don't know that I've ever seen as many this early in the year as we're seeing right now. I mean, you turn on your porch light, or when you go out to get in your car in the morning, you open that door, that dome light comes on, and it's like just an onslaught of them. So I'm concerned about what grub damage we're going to see this year. And we, of course, are telling people the beneficial nematodes are one of the best things out there to stop the grub damage. But that's the one insect pest, even though it's not the June bug itself, it's those first and second larval instars that I fear we may see a lot of damage from this year if people aren't a little proactive.
Well, one of the things that I recommend when I do my pest control talks and everything to everybody I talk to is that we all should put out beneficial nematodes and trichogramma wasps at this time of the year, you know, even earlier when the foliage starts to grow. And if you do that on a regular basis, especially if you do it in the fall as well, mm-hmm. I think you build up a situation where even grub worms just don't have a chance to survive. So
yeah.
I'll get a little bit of pushback about trichogramma wasp, people thinking that it will hurt butterfly eggs, but I just don't see evidence of that yet. Do you?
Yeah, we don't either. We don't see any evidence of that, because that's one thing. We've seen the big old swallowtails and the a wide range of very colorful, very desirable butterflies already this year. So, no, I don't think there's any concern at all there.
By the way, that reminds me, I got a response from Rincon Vitova this week that they are still very much in business. But it was interesting. I haven't called her back to talk to her yet. Yeah, the person that called me, but they said that they had been hearing that quite a bit, and it's kind of interesting. When I talk to her, I'll find out more of the story, and I'll have a more of a report for you next week probably. But they are there. The list of insectaries that we have on DirtDoctor.com, I think, is pretty up-to-date and good, but I'll take a look at that, and we'll update that if we need to as well.
Very good, and I need to take a look at that myself. I don't know if you have hydro gardens on there, which for many years have been our principal source of beneficial nematodes. They are no longer in business, but they basically sold out and sold their technology and everything that they do to a company out of Oregon called Nature's Control, and they are continuing to package live beneficial nematodes on the sponge, the same way that the people at Hydro Gardens did. They're having trouble keeping up with the demand at this point. That's our biggest problem. Is we ask is to send us 200 packages, and they say we can only send you 50 right now. So that's another one of our. They're not an insectary, of course. Well, I don't know. I think they may actually have been producing some of the trichogramma, but. That's another company we need to take off the list, but add the Nature's Control in their place, because it's basically the same technology, just a different company in a different location.
Yeah, I looked into that too. They're not taking over the whole Hydro Gardens business. They're not. Mm-hmm. They're just doing some specific things like the nematodes.
Right.
And
right.
We have already made that change, and I'm going to be talking to them more too. So things are changing, just like. You know, relating back to this COVID deal, you know, there's still people, restaurant business coming into business and going out of business. I'm seeing it all over the place, and the same thing apparently is happening in our world here too.
It's a strange world out there, and we'll save that discussion for another time. But as always, Howard, we appreciate so much you taking a bit of your Saturday morning with us to help everybody across the area garden a little bit better. So, oh, golly, I didn't even think about it. This is April Fool's Day. I remember one year you got me on the air with such a prank. I hadn't thought about that. But anyway, so be careful out there today, because there may be some mischievous people out there. But in the meantime, have a great week, and I'll look forward to doing this again next Saturday.
Enjoy it. See you next week.
Sounds great, Howard. Thank you so much. Mr. Howard Garrett is the Dirt Doctor. DirtDoctor.com is the website we talk about, source of a tremendous amount of good information. Very applicable. Of course, Howard's up in the Metroplex, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But what you find, what we talk about, what he talks about on his show, what you find on DirtDoctor.com, very much applicable down here.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening, and Jimmy tells me that Omar called and wants to talk for a minute. Time for maybe one or two more phone calls if you want to dial. Otherwise, I've got plenty of things to tell you about. But right now, let's see what Omar's up to. Good morning, sir.
Hello, Bob. How you doing?
Off to a good start. It's going to be a beautiful day out there.
Yes, it is. Rain tanks are full, and we've got plenty to do.
Great way to start a weekend, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I'm running extremely late. I started from seed this year, and I'm still in my little, you know, little cell starters. You know, my plants are tiny. But experimenting with some other stuff. I've got gourds coming up pretty good. Is that a ground growing thing? Does it need to climb something, or what do you do with them? Or chain link fence or something?
It depends, you know. There are more different kinds of gourds than there are different kinds of squash, so it really depends on the variety. Most of them will produce a nicer gourd if they have something to climb on. They will produce if they're just spreading out across the ground, but that side that's on the ground is more susceptible to insect damage. Plus, it's not going to develop the beautiful colors that some of the gourds get, and you don't want a soft spot on the side of the gourd if you're growing things like those so-called birdhouse gourds that people will dry and then drill and make Martin houses out of. So across the board, I'd say probably 90% of the gourds are going to be best if they have something to grow up on, but it's not 100% necessary.
Okay. Yeah, it's a bigger variety, not the name. I forget the name of them, but that's what my plan is, to kind of make things out of them, you know, clean them out and dry them and do whatever.
One other thing I would tell you, Omar, is that, you know, some of the bigger ones get pretty heavy, and some of them, like the loofahs, you know, they're not so bad. They kind of hang down out of the trees. But if you grow on any of the ornamental ones that are really heavy, like up a fence or up a trellis or something like that, sometimes you have to be a little creative in supporting them so that they don't end up breaking and stripping the vine. I knew an old fellow over in Seguin that actually made little platforms that he could then, you know, kind of hook into the fence. I've known other gentlemen who say they got a couple of old pairs of their ladies' pantyhose and use those to, in effect, make a sling to support them. But just watch them, and if you feel like, you know, that the weight on them is going to strip them or cause a problem, I'm sure you're creative enough to come up with a way to support them a little bit. But it's kind of disappointing to get one halfway mature and then just suddenly find it on the ground one morning and know it's not going to grow anymore.
Yeah. And I got a spare. I could never find asparagus a little further along, so I started some from seed, and they're coming up. Is that a full sun plant?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The more sun, the fuller and thicker it will be. You can certainly grow it from seed. You're going to have to wait a little bit longer for the plants to mature enough that you can start harvesting from them. And you're going to get a lot of variation. Some of the plants are going to, you know, produce a nice big, thick asparagus. Some of them are going to, at least at first, be a little thinner, a little bit more pencil-like. But the beauty here is if you're growing a bunch of seeds, and when they do start producing, you can do what we call roguing out. You can go through and just the ones that aren't making a good asparagus, you can just, you know, pull them up and dispose of them and let the good ones continue to grow and flourish.
Gotcha. And I've only got about seven that came up, would all of those go into one? I raised bed out of the 225-pound tubs. You know, molasses tubs. Do all those go in one, or is it one per?
A molasses tub, I think you could probably put probably about five or six plants in there and still have room for them to grow. You don't want to crowd them too much. You know, plant mine are more in a row, and I tend to plant them about 18 inches apart, but they're not really going to crowd each other that much. And what you're going to do is around the first of the year, if they haven't frozen back, you're going to cut them down to ground level. So it's not like you're having to make your way through the vines to be able to harvest them. You're going to be dealing with just a plain flat surface and just picking off the new spears as they come up. So, no, you can put quite a few in a molasses tub. I'd say 5 to 7 in one tub.
Gotcha. All righty, sir, and I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your call this morning. You get out and have a wonderful weekend. I know we'll visit again, Omar. Thank you, sir.
Sure will. Thank you.
Okay. Couple of other things. Planting in the landscapes, there are a lot of things you can be setting out now. And one thing that, and if you're growing things in containers and houseplants and things like that, one of the biggest misconceptions is that plants don't like to be root bound. With trees and shrubs, we don't like to have them root bound when we're getting ready to put them into the landscape, because we need to cut those roots that are out toward the edge of the container so we don't end up with circling and girdling roots on down the way. But it being root bound does not harm house plants when you have things that you're going to grow, oh, say out around a pool or something like that, bougainvilleas, hibiscus. Those plants are much happier if they are root-bound, and they will bloom better if they are. And I see people kill a large number of plants just because they buy them and think the first thing they need to do is repot them. No, repotting is just not always necessary. And the only two times that I tell people to repot are either when the plant has become so top-heavy that you can't keep it standing up, or when the plant is simply drying out so fast that you can't keep it appropriately watered. More roots you've got in that pot, the faster it's going to dry out, and eventually it'll get to the point where you're thinking you have to water twice a day to keep it happy. Well, that's a good reason to put things into a little bit bigger pot. But especially houseplants, don't rush to repot them, because I'd say there are more plants killed from being overpotted then there are causes anytime a plant has gotten too root-bound. Again, it may get to the point that they dry out so quickly that you will be better off to put them into a larger pot. But in general, they're going to be much better off if they're growing in a little bit smaller pot, because the soil will dry more evenly and the plants will simply do much better. And this is especially true, you know, if you're growing shrubs and trees and things like that in containers on your patio. Again, if you've got that, you know, that planter that's, you know, 18 inches in diameter and all you've got are 1 gallon bougainvilleas, we'll put 3 of them to the pot. It's going to make a much prettier plant much more quickly, and individually each one of those 3 plants will do much better than if you put one small plant into one great big container. Oh golly, so many things to tell you about. If you're mowing for the first time, don't scalp it. That's something we used to think was a good thing to do. Cut down low enough that you are taking off most of the dead grass blades and controlling most of the weeds, and do follow it up. You know, leave the clippings on the ground. You're just wasting a lot of good, valuable organic material if you're bagging it or raking it up. But follow it up, spray it down with some Garrett juice, some molasses, something like that, that's going to speed up the decomposition of the leaf material that you're leaving on the yard. But it is time probably to make that first mowing. But scalping, no, we don't do that anymore. We set your mower down to a little bit lower level so that you take off most of the old dead grass blades. But scalping, no, don't do that. If you are seeing as many June bugs and things as we are, it is a good time to start putting out your beneficial nematodes, because those June bugs are going to be out there laying eggs, and it's the little small grub worms that do the majority of the damage. We call it the first and second larval instars. Those big old grubs that you may see digging around in the soil, they're just waiting to pupate and form June bugs. They're no longer feeding on the roots of your plants. But if you're seeing the adult June bugs, next thing that's going to come along are the little June bugs that do all the damage. And by far, the most effective control that we have found is the live beneficial nematodes. Do not go out and put those toxic poisons out. Half the time, they don't work well. They are very harmful for your pets and your kids and yourself. So stay away from that kind of thing. Also, fertilizing is so important. If you haven't had the time to fertilize this spring, make this the weekend that you do it. There are a lot of good organic fertilizers out there. Medina's got two great granular fertilizers now. Nature's Creation has one. Maestro has one. And then, of course, there are good liquid fertilizers as well. But the nutrients are really important to help your plants come out. So if you haven't fertilized in the past 60 to 90 days, make it a point to do so. If you did fertilize last fall, it's time to follow it up again with more fertilizer this spring. And remember, with the organic fertilizers, they do not have to be watered in. They won't really go to work until they're watered, so water when it's convenient. But don't put off fertilizing just because you think you have to rush out and water immediately after you put it out. Those things can lie there for some time. And looks like we're going to have one of our strongest rain chances we've had in quite a while coming along toward the end of next week. So, you know, get your fertilizing done and get those bedding plants in the ground. We're right at the cusp of the time. I'm not going to tell you absolutely that you're okay to plant periwinkles, but it looks like we're warming up to the point. But don't overdo it. If you're planting huge beds and things, you might want to give it another week or two just to head off the disease issues.